Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Dirt Nap City, the podcast about interesting dead people. I am here today with one very interesting alive person named Alex. What are you up to, Alex?
How's it going, Kelly?
It's going great. I heard you got a package in the mail today.
I did. I got a secret admirer. It was funny. The box said something about bio bags.
Yes. I did think about that when I packed it. Those are like what you put your kitchen waste in, so you can put them in the, the compost.
Oh, I thought bio bags were for dog waste. I thought they were like pooper scooper bags.
No. You want much beefier bags than those if you're going to pick up dog poop, because those bio bags are designed to be like basically biodegradable pretty quickly, and they don't have enough content for picking up dog turds.
Well, I didn't know what it was, and I was afraid somebody sent me a bag of poop.
Well, at least it would have been in a bio bag.
But luckily, it was a Dirt Nap City t-shirt.
Sweet.
Yeah.
And if you want your own Dirt Nap City t-shirt, let us know, because we got them. They are print on demand. Admittedly, they're a little pricey at this point because they're low volume. But you know, when we start selling hundreds, they're going to get cheaper. But you know what? They're going to be limited run. We're only going to do this color, this gray color, for a short period of time. And if you 5 years from now are walking around in a gray Dirt Nap City t-shirt, you'll be one of the coolest people on the planet.
And demand sounds a little aggressive. I mean, you can just request one. You don't have to demand it of us.
Yeah, sorry. I was going hard on that. Well, so I'm very excited today. I have someone that I think will be of great interest to everyone. This person, gentleman, was born in 1769. He also, this is a big clue, he liked to wear big pointy hats.
You know, before you said that, I was about to say the only person I can think of might be Napoleon.
And my next clue was going to be, when you see his portrait, you often think of an Alanis Morissette song.
It's not Napoleon?
It is.
Oh. Okay.
Because he had one hand in his pocket and the other was holding a big hat.
Napoleon. Yeah. They just came out with a movie about that guy.
You know, the whole reason I'm doing this is because I watched that movie.
Oh.
I didn't read a book in this case.
How'd you like the movie?
Well, have you seen it?
No.
I enjoyed it. I thought that Joaquin Phoenix did a great job. Like, the acting was really interesting. Definitely after, so I watched the movie a couple of weeks ago, and then I decided this would be my topic. And after going through his life and all the battles he fought and everything, I realized the movie was greatly, greatly simplified, but it did catch some key moments. And so I liked it. Jody fell asleep, but it was also, no, we saw it at home. It's on Disney Plus now, or on Apple or something. We started it a little too late. It's like 3 hours long, and we started it at like 8 p.m. You know, it's a little late for us old folks. But worth seeing. If you are interested at all in Napoleon, and if you like sort of that period timepiece war movie stuff, here's an interesting thing about that movie is he doesn't, well, you know, they're obviously French. None of them have any sort of French accent. As a matter of fact, a lot of the French people in the movie have an English accent, and Joaquin Phoenix has a American accent. He just talks like himself.
Yeah. I always wondered in those cases, because it also wouldn't be historically accurate to have them have a French accent speaking English.
Right. No, I think that would actually be worse. I agree with their decision. It was just interesting to listen to the different accents in the movie, even though they were portraying, you know, because first of all, one thing you got to know about Napoleon is he hated the English, did not like the English. They was always at war with the English. And so for these people in his army to have an English accent, kind of, you know, if you know that about him, it's a little bit disturbing. But I mean, he just spoke straight up like Joaquin Phoenix.
Well, I'm looking forward to this because I do not know a lot about Napoleon. And this perfectly fits in the wheelhouse of everybody knows the name. Most people don't know anything beyond the surface of that. So I can't wait.
Most people think his last name was Dynamite.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. It wasn't. Are you telling me?
No.
It wasn't? Okay.
Bonaparte.
Bonaparte.
Interestingly, though, he was actually Italian. His family was Italian, but sort of Italian. They were of Italian descent. He was born in Corsica, which is a part of the Republic of Genoa from 1284 to 1755. Now, Genoa is now a part of Italy. But what happened is it actually seceded from Genoa and became a free and independent country, the island did, of Corsica, from 1755 to 1768. But Genoa never really recognized that. And so they actually gave Louis the 15th of France Corsica as part of a deal to pay off some debt, because France had helped Genoa, like militarily, had done some things to help them militarily.
So technically he was Italian, but probably wasn't like culturally Italian.
Napoleon actually moved to France when he was 9 years old to attend a military school. And he was teased a bit because he didn't actually speak French at that point. He spoke Italian and Corsican, but he didn't speak French until he was about 10 years old. And he started getting teased and made fun of because basically, you know, he was an outsider and people, you know, the other kids gave him a hard time about that. However, there are stories that when he kind of learned French and got to be more adjusted at the school in France, he started to take leadership seriously, and he actually was became more popular, was able to lead students in various ways. And one of the most famous stories is about him leading a group of junior students against a group of senior students in a snowball fight that they won, the junior students won.
Oh, wow. That is great leadership.
It really is. He briefly wanted to be a writer, but he didn't end up being a writer. When his father died, he joined the military, and he basically had to graduate quicker than the other students because he couldn't afford to stay there because his father had passed away and he didn't have much income. But he was the first Corsican to graduate from this military school. It was called École Militaire in Paris.
Yeah, that's French for military school.
Right, right. When he graduated, he became a second lieutenant. And then, this was in 1785, so he spent 4 years as a second lieutenant doing his thing in the military. And then in 1789, the French Revolution broke out. Now, the French Revolution was pretty complicated, bloody, a lot of things going on. I mean, that's when Marie Antoinette had her head cut off. And because he was Corsican, he was kind of stuck in this weird position of being a military man in the French army. He became part of the French Revolution, and he got stationed in Corsica again. So he had this kind of weird three-way thing going, because the Corsicans wanted to be free of France completely. The revolutionaries wanted to be free of the royals, and the royals wanted to keep things the way they were.
He was torn.
No, he wasn't. He was very dedicated to Corsica and to the revolutionary cause. He didn't believe that the royal government of France was serving France well.
Oh, so he was just, but he was in a place where it was very torn. The opinions were very volatile.
Yes, yes. And lots, you know, three different factions fighting for three different things. He ended up actually getting pretty recognized and well known because he led a mission in Corsica to capture a hill. Now, the British were occupying Corsica at the time. So this was going on during the French Revolution. The British are occupying Corsica. He's in Corsica. There's people who want to break away from the French, the native Corsicans want to break away from the French. There's the military there. He ended up leading a squadron or a troop of soldiers up a hill and captured this hill with cannons on it, was able to turn the cannons, these were British cannons, and fire on British ships, causing the British to actually retreat from the island. And that kind of made him famous.
Well, it's similar to the snowball fight. It was just a bigger scale at that point. He had experience in this.
What happened then in March of 1796, after the French Revolution was over, he met and married Josephine de Beauharnais. I'm saying her name wrong. Josephine, as she was known. Absolutely beautiful woman, at least as depicted in the movie. She was beautiful.
Was she French?
She was French, yes. And he was becoming more and more French. But 2 days after they married, he actually was told to go and take command of the army in Italy. And so he ended up going to Italy in 1796, right after 2 days after he was married. And then it kind of gets into this whole set of battles he was in. Now, you know, France, we like to say in Texas that France is smaller than Texas, isn't it? Or about the same size?
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think France is...
But Texas is huge.
As far as states go, yeah.
Yeah.
It is. I guess even as far as European countries go, it's pretty big. But France today is 211,000 square miles, or 547,000 square kilometers. At the height of the French Empire, it was 2.1 million square kilometers, or 800,000 square miles. So about four times as big as it is today. Now, by comparison, the British Empire's size at its height, you want to guess when the British Empire crested, when it was like at its biggest?
At its peak?
Yeah.
Was it in the 1700s? Was it
no, later much later. Much later, yeah.
Yeah, that was probably right in the 20th century then, maybe?
1920.
Okay. Between World War I and World War II.
Now, remember I said France was 2.1 million square kilometers? The height of the British Empire was 35.5 million square kilometers.
Yeah.
Or 26% of Earth's land mass.
Right. That's why English is spoken in so much of the world, I suppose.
Yeah. I guess that makes a point. But, you know, just like them, just like the French, the British Empire is much smaller today.
Do you know how I knew that that part of Texas used to be under French rule?
From
a little amusement park called Six Flags.
Oh, that's right. That's
one of the flags that used to fly over Six Flags.
Do you know all six of the flags?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to test me on that?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go.
France, Spain, Mexico, United States, the Confederacy, and the Republic of Texas.
Nice. So that actually, there's a little bit of a tangent here, but you know, now there's like Six Flags all over the country. There's like a Six Flags in St. Louis. There's a Six Flag. Is that still just the Six Flags of Texas?
I think
just
so. Called,
it doesn't have anything to do with those states' heritage.
No,
right?
Because Texas was Texas. Like it wasn't in St. Louis and the company Six Flags. Yeah. They're in like in New Jersey, and obviously New Jersey was never part of Texas, and there were never Six Flags over New Jersey. I think originally it was called Six Flags over Texas.
Yeah. Yes. I remember that. As a matter of fact, that was a Dallas thing, I think. You know, we had Astroworld in Houston.
Arlington. Yeah.
I never went to Six Flags over Texas, but I always heard it was better than Astroworld, just like the Cowboys were better than the Oilers.
well, I went and it wasn't. So,
so that kind of begs a question. If you're from one of these other states that has a Six Flags, what Six Flags do they have up there?
It's the same Six Flags, but they don't make any sense.
Yeah, so why would you have a Texas flag up in Missouri?
I don't know.
In St. Louis.
Huh. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I hope someone from one of those other places. Was there one in Detroit, the Six Flags over Detroit?
No. Although I think Six Flags ended up buying a bunch of amusement parks that already existed.
And so rebranding them.
It wouldn't surprise me if there were Six Flags of places that I used go as a kid, like in Ohio or whatever.
Yeah.
But no, I think the Six Flags is just Six Flags over Texas. But
okay. Huh. Well, France was one of them, and you're right. It was a part of the. As a matter of fact, while we're on the topic, you know how much we paid, the United States paid for the Louisiana purchase of all that land?
I think it was cheap. I think it was a couple hundred bucks, wasn't it?
No.
I'm thinking of New York. It was like a dollar.
It was 3 cents per acre.
Okay.
But it was 5 million acres. So okay. It was 15 million dollars, I think, is what it worked out to.
Like I said, a couple of hundred bucks. And for that, we got what, Louisiana?
We got Arkansas. We got Missouri. We got Iowa. We got Oklahoma. We got Kansas. We got Nebraska. We got a large part of North Dakota and South Dakota. We got some parts of Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, east of the Continental Divide. We got a little bit of Minnesota. We got New Mexico, the northern part of Texas, and state of Louisiana.
It's a pretty good bargain. 15 million bucks.
And small parts of Alberta and Saskatchewan were part of the Louisiana purchase.
Oh, and then we ended up giving that back to Canada?
Yeah, I think there's a line, you know, there's a, is it latitude or longitude?
Mm-hmm.
Latitudinal line or a longitudinal line that basically everything above it is Canada and everything below it's the United States. And interestingly, I don't know if you know this, there is actually a city, I believe it's in Michigan, that is completely surrounded by Canada because of that line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You in the winter, when there's a lake that freezes, they can drive into the U.S. directly. In the summer, when that lake is wet, they have to drive through Canada to get into the U.S. It is a United States city.
Interesting. So,
yeah. I mean, you know, Napoleon, he really impacted a lot of things.
Sure.
So, you know, he went to war with all kinds of countries. I mean, he fought with Prussia. He fought with Russia. He fought with Britain. He really fought with Britain a lot. He fought with Spain. He fought with Portugal. And, you know, he won most of those things. He was actually pretty well feared because he was a pretty well known and, I guess, effective commander.
So were these defensive or were they aggression?
Primarily aggression.
All right. So he was trying to take over.
Yeah. They became the French Empire. You know, they weren't just France at that time. They were the French Empire.
Sure.
Now he became the first emperor of France. And do you know the difference between an emperor and a king?
You mean those five people picked him to be the emperor?
No. This was years later. After the Directory. So the Directory was when he was kind of starting his military career. I'm skipping forward. As a matter of fact, I'm skipping forward from what year? From 1796 to 1802.
Okay.
Let's just say he fought a bunch of battles between those years. And in 1804, he was super popular. The Directory, everybody said, you've won so many battles. You've made you've made France such a great empire. You can be the emperor of France.
So the difference between an empire and a king, I would think, would be in terms of lines of succession, that the emperor's heirs wouldn't automatically also become emperors. Is that true?
No. No, oh. that is incorrect.
Would an emperor be over an empire rather than a country?
Yes. So a king would be over a kingdom, whereas a king is a male ruler who reigns over a specific individual kingdom or realm, where an emperor controls multiple kingdoms or territories and is therefore superior to the king.
Oh, there's place. Okay. So there would be a king that would report to an emperor.
Yes. It's like governors and president kind of thing. Now, a lot of those kings were appointed by Napoleon over the years, and basically, a lot of times, they would get that appointment with the understanding that they would be loyal to the emperor. He was coronated as emperor, as I said, in 1804, and the name of the pope that coronated him, I think he's got a great name. When I first saw it, I thought it was an early hybrid vehicle from Toyota, but I realized I was misreading it. It's not Pope Prius. It's Pope Pius the Seventh.
Oh, yeah. Pius, yeah.
You plug him in as he goes forever. He did the coronation. I just think that's such a great name for a pope, Pius.
Yeah. Probably a lot of travel with that job.
Yes. So he was a very hands-on emperor. He went into battle. He didn't just send his troops into battle. As a matter of fact, he had several wars called the Wars of the Coalitions. And the Wars of the Coalitions, I think there were seven of them. They were all wars where other countries formed a coalition against him. Or he attacked one of them and ended up getting, fighting not just that country that he attacked. He attacked Austria multiple times. Mm-hmm. He attacked Spain. He attacked Portugal. He attacked Russia. He attacked, he just kind of was out trying to get this great land, this great empire, take over all of Europe. And then these coalitions would form and fight him back a little bit. And then he'd go out and fight again. And this went on for years and years. In 1804, just shortly after his coronation, he had an army of 350,000 men who were well-trained, well-equipped, and he ended up going to Naples and put his brother Joseph in charge of Italy. After he had been declared king of Italy, but then he declared his brother Joseph king of Italy. And then he made his other brother, Joseph was his older brother, he made his younger brother the king of Holland.
So was this a deal of like attack or be attacked, or was it to try to like spread the French way of life? Or you think, I mean, was there some sort of manifest destiny here? Why try to take over the world like this?
A lot of people say it was his personality, that he was narcissistic and he was insecure, and that he did this to sort of prove himself again and again. And that was his really strong suit, was military tactics. He was very good at that. So I think he was trying to play to his strong suit. But I think after you punch enough people in the nose, you start to get really unpopular with the rest of Europe, right? Yeah, and so, so I think it later became that sort of attack or be attacked thing. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of haters in Prussia, and this coalition decided to go up against him. So he attacked Prussia with 180,000 troops, and he defeated them. He inflicted heavy casualties, and he captured 140,000 soldiers and 2,000 cannons. But despite all this, Prussia did not negotiate, mm-hmm. and the Russians came to their aid. But the Russians actually got pretty beat by the French at that time as well. And during that time, he was actually considering... His wife, he had not been able to have a child, right? Josephine had not produced a child for him. So after defeating a good majority of the Russian army, he made friends with the Tsar of Russia, whose name was Alexander, and tried to get Alexander to let him marry his sister. But Alexander refused, saying she was too young and he didn't want that to happen. So he ended up, another former adversary, Austria, he decided he wanted to marry somebody so he could have a strategic alliance with another sort of culture, even though the Austrians and the German or the Austrians and the French had fought so many times. He ended up marrying the daughter, divorcing Josephine because she couldn't give a baby, and marrying the daughter of the Austrian emperor, whose name was Mary Louise, who happened to be the grandniece of Marie Antoinette. So...
But he had attacked Austria over and over and over.
Yes, yes. This was the funny thing was they kind of went back and forth many times. There was actually a time when he tried to make peace or make allegiances in the Middle East, and he had made allegiances with the Turks. He had made allegiances with Egypt in the Middle East, and then he betrayed them by making an allegiance with Russia, who wanted to invade that part of Turkey, and he ended up going along with Russia. So they would kind of flip-flop. The only one he never really made friends with or made any allegiances with was England, because he hated England.
Yeah. It's also exhausting, really.
It's so exhausting. I mean, he lost... It's said that during all these wars, it's estimated that between 13 and 15 million people died.
Wow. Really, and he could trace it back to just him picking fights.
Well, he was involved in the Napoleonic Wars, right? You've heard that term.
So would you, by today's standards, would you call him a dictator then?
So historians believe that when he began, he was pretty idealistic. He actually did some really good things for France after the French Revolution in terms of education for men, right? He wasn't very big on women's rights. I don't think anybody was back then, or at least not men. No men were back then. maybe the women were. But he, I guess as a ruler back then, he became more and more narcissistic, and he also became more and more superstitious. He was a big believer in fate, stars, numerology. He often asked his generals if they were feeling lucky, and he was pretty serious. Like if they said no, he didn't want them to go into battle.
Shoot him.
Yeah. You feeling lucky, kid?
This reminds me of the Henry VIII conversation when you're like, yeah, but he, you know, he did some good too. And then,
well, you know, it's definitely, I think at the end of the day, if you were to say, what did he do, good or bad? I think the bad outweighed the good, yeah, by a long shot.
But the people in France, did they like him at the time? Did he take care of them?
They did. Until, remember I was talking about these coalitions, these wars of coalition? Mm-hmm. So he basically won the first six. And then the seventh coalition that he, and by the way, in one of those wars of coalition, he actually was able to make another relative of his the king of Spain. You know, so yeah, he would go into these places, kick their butts, and then make a relative king. That was sort of his MO in these things. But, you know, he won the third coalition, the fourth coalition, with, of course, getting pushed back and losing troops and, you know, having its ups and downs. Some of these were very clear wins. Some of them weren't. But ultimately, the seventh coalition was the one that got him. And after all these years and years and years of war, he actually was stripped of his emperorship. Like he was taken to live on an island by himself.
The island of Elba?
Elba, yes.
I've heard of
that
this.
That was his first banishment. Now, he was on Elba with about 1,200 inhabitants. Now, this was in the Mediterranean.
I always off the coast. Elba to be like a deserted island where it was just him by himself, like with his record collection, like a desert island his, collection.
Desert island and his monocle and his big pointy hat. No, so actually, funny enough, you have it right, but you have the timing off, and I'll explain. He was banished to the Isle of Elba, and he was given sovereignty over the island. He was actually allowed to be the emperor of Elba Island.
But that's like a really tiny place, right? So here he was. He used to rule the French Empire, and now he rules this little
Elba Island.
Right.
Well, so there were buildings. There was industry. There were about 12,000 people in the Mediterranean. There were ships that came in and out for trading, and he actually commandeered a ship while he was there and sailed back to France. Now, part of this was triggered by two things. Number one, he always carried with him a pill, a suicide pill, but he had carried it in a little thing around his neck, like a little, you know, twist off container around his neck on a necklace. Mm. He had carried it for so long that when he finally tried to use it on the Isle of Elba, because he was thinking he was going to just give up, it had lost its potency.
Expired medicine.
Yes, made him throw up, and he was
really?
He was like, okay. Then while he was out in Elba, he found out that Josephine had died, and he never stopped loving Josephine. He actually loved her more than he loved his second wife, who gave him a child, but Josephine couldn't give him a child, so that was why he divorced her. So when he found that out, he commandeered a ship, and he sailed back to France. And when he got to France, he was actually met by soldiers because they had heard he was coming. King Louis sent this soldier, General Ney, out to intercept him and bring him back. And Ney said, yes, I'll bring him back to you in a cage. Well, Ney gets out there, and when he does, Napoleon has a couple of hundred men with him. But Napoleon gets off his horse, and he walks towards Ney in the middle of the road, towards the other soldiers, and he says, if you want to shoot your emperor, go ahead, but I don't think you will. And basically, Ney bent down, kissed his hand, and said, you know, I've missed you. You were my emperor.
Wow.
And I am loyal to you.
That is charisma there.
So what happened is Ney and his men and Napoleon and his men went ahead and marched into Paris. And Louis was so unpopular that he knew he wouldn't be able to get the popularity. I guess people had forgotten, you know, all the things that Napoleon had done at this point, and they basically let him go back into power. But it only lasted 100 days, and it was called the period of 100 days in France. He thought he had momentum, so he decided to go on the offensive with the military, who welcomed him back, against the British and the Prussian armies, because he hated the British, and yeah, he had been sitting on an island stewing. This was the Battle of Waterloo that
during
he
the 100 days.
During the 100 days, on June 18th, 1815, he ended up getting defeated by the British and Prussian armies in Waterloo, which again was part of Belgium now, is a part of Belgium now, but was part of the Netherlands at the time. So now, what do they do with him? They don't execute him. They send him out to be banished again, and the British sent him to the island of St. Helena in the Atlantic. Now, this one was not just a hop, skip, and a jump away from France. This was 1,100 miles off the coast of West Africa. Mm. So it was a little bit further out to sea. And the British had 2,100 soldiers stationed there and 10 ships. And part of their duty there was to keep him from escaping.
Yeah. The first time didn't take. They gave him too much, kind of too much freedom. But even then, he tried to kill himself.
Yeah, yeah, the first time. The second time, he ended up settling into this place called Longwood House. And believe it or not, it's actually still there on the island of St. Helena. You can actually visit it or see pictures of it, where he lived. Apparently, it was this was where he lived on kind of a rock.
So this is out near Africa.
Not near, 1,100 miles away. But yes, the closest city was in Africa from there.
Wow, okay.
So This is about as remote as you get. So he lived in this place called Longwood House. There were rats. It was unhealthy. It was not a great place to live. However, he did still have occasional visitors. He would have sort of visitations from other dignitaries. He would receive them. He would visit with them. He would drink with them. You know, he was not treated like, you know, bread and water kind of prisoner. He was treated more like a royal prisoner, but it wasn't a great situation. You know, this was the rock I think you were thinking of.
I don't know. Might be a Schoolhouse Rock kind of thing where they showed him on an island with a palm tree and by himself.
Yeah. But this was definitely a lot more of that than the first banishment. But, you know, I wonder if it was me and I was the king of England at the time, or, you know, a British general or something, would you let him live again after all this?
No, they were far too kind to him. I mean, I think people have been executed for far less than this, and he probably executed people for far less than this himself.
He did.
Too.
He did. Yeah. There was a lot of, there was sort of a lot of thought among the haters of Napoleon that he had it too good. But he didn't really, because his health got bad, and in 1821, he died on Cinco de Mayo. That actually means death of Napoleon, 1821, at the age of 51.
51. Wow. That's a big life. That's a big life.
Well, I mean, you know, putting it in perspective, you and I are a little north of that, right?
Yeah. The people that we talk about from like the 18th century, especially the ones that are in charge that do a lot of traveling back and forth, I don't understand how they have such short lives, because it takes like a year to get somewhere. You know, right, 6 months to get somewhere and then 6 months to get back. And it just seems like that part alone just takes years off your life. But yeah, wow, he lived a big life. So I have a couple of questions. One, sure. What part of his life did the movie cover?
It covered from the time he kind of rose to military power, like when the French Revolution was happening, and he took that, was in Corsica and took that hill and was able to fire on the British Navy. It's kind of where it starts, and all the way through his death.
So it doesn't show the snowball fight.
No, the snowball fight was not there. Josephine's a big part of it.
You have to listen to this podcast to get the snowball fight part of his
life. Yeah, that's true. Or read Wikipedia.
All right. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was, I don't know if you know this, but I'm a gentleman of small stature. A short guy. And as a short guy, growing up, anytime I'd assert my, or be assertive, I would always be accused of having a Napoleon complex. That's basically a short guy that is basically too big for his britches and tries to like assert dominance over somebody. And I know, being a psychologist, there's not much to that. There's not any kind of a thing where short people have this complex. There's nothing to support that. But how short was he? Do you know?
So, yes, interesting. You should ask. He was 5'2". However, the French used 5'2". The French used a different system of measurement for feet and inches. So that actually translated to 5'6" in English.
That's like, about how tall I am.
So, here's the other thing that was interesting. He did have an elite royal guard that was always around him, like bodyguards, because he did have several assassination attempts on him. These were big guys. So it'd be kind of like a tallish guy like me walking out onto an NBA court, right? It's all comparison. So mm-hmm. I think a lot of people thought he was shorter than he was because he was always with these guys who were 6'5", 6'2", you know, whatever, these big guys that were part of his royal guard. So that is definitely something that people talked about, but it was also talked about that maybe he just had insecurity because of the fact that he had grown up as an outsider, as a Corsican, you know, moving into France. Wasn't it really a native to France?
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I'm glad you put that to rest.
Yeah. Well, it was said again, he started off pretty well after he took power. He just kind of had a lot of yes men around him, and he became more and more paranoid because he did have some assassination attempts. He did write what was called the Napoleonic Code. Have you heard of that?
Yes.
So that was, it was basically at the time, there weren't clearly written laws. And because there were so many different kingdoms and fiefdoms and villages and, you know, local versus sort of national laws, he tried to, for the entire French Empire, tried to make this one Napoleonic Code that gave people a guide for things like civil code, equality before the law, religious tolerance, property rights, inheritance for children, kind of getting away from feudalism. These were all the things that he did that were very positive early on, this Napoleonic Code. But as I said, it really didn't treat women, especially women who were divorced. It treated them very poorly, and people of color very poorly.
I remember hearing that the Louisiana Constitution is based on Napoleonic Code somehow.
Huh. That could be because Louisiana. So, and it's also interesting, the colony of Louisiana, you know, we think of Louisiana as a state that's a sort of average size state, right? The colony of Louisiana was all of that territory that we mentioned earlier. All those states that we mentioned earlier were a part of it. But here's what's interesting. Yeah. The actual density of French people in that area was very, very low. So when the U.S. bought Louisiana. Oh, and by the way, the land that we bought from France had been under the control of Spain for a long time, and Napoleon actually got it back from Spain through his way of intimidating, and he battled with them and won it as a concession. And so it was under Spanish rule for a while, but it was French. However, there just weren't a lot of French people living there. It was mostly Native Americans. So when we bought it from France, we bought it. We were basically saying, we're going to buy this area and have the right to go in and either buy it from the natives or fight with them and take it from them. You know, that was kind of what we were buying. We weren't actually anything that they controlled, that France controlled, really. They just had it on paper.
Oh, yeah. And there wasn't a lot to it either. It was mostly swampland.
Well, no, I mean, we're talking about Missouri and Kansas and...
Oh, right. I thought you meant Louisiana.
No, I meant that whole piece of property. Right. Yeah.
That whole... Yeah. You're right.
But it was, you know, Thomas Jefferson was the president at the time, and he really wanted the... he really wanted it because it basically was our way westward, right? It was the way, because up until that time, we kind of stopped, the U.S. stopped at the Mississippi. It was our way to get beyond the Mississippi. And you know who negotiated that deal as part of the negotiation with France? It was James Madison.
Oh, yeah. Oh, nice.
You thought I was going to say Roosevelt, right?
Yeah.
Would have been a little off, but James Madison.
Yeah, a little off.
So one of the big things he did in France because of his hatred for England is there was pretty much always an embargo on trade with England. Like he wouldn't let anybody in his empire trade with England, just sort of flat out. So one of the things he would do is if he saw a woman that was wearing clothing that he thought was made in England, he would actually throw ink on it.
Jesus.
Or spill food on
it. That's inappropriate.
Well, you know, he was Vive la France, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
He also was said to have enjoyed hot baths, extremely hot baths. But one of the reasons is he's also said to have had painful hemorrhoids throughout his life.
You know, he did a lot of things in his life, but but post-mortem, if that's what people say about you, that you had painful hemorrhoids, I mean,
yeah,
he must have always been complaining about it in order for that to be something that we know.
Well,
200 years later.
You know, it's funny how those things stick sometimes. You're a big baseball fan. You know, I have a connection to Kansas City through my family, and my grandparents would have season tickets to the Royals. And you know, George Brett.
Oh, I know where you're going with
George
this.
Brett.
I know where you're going with this.
Was a very, very excellent baseball player. But one of the things I remember about him is that he suffered from hemorrhoids.
I remember that too. I remember the poor guy.
Yeah, it's. I don't want that.
Millions of Americans suffer from hemorrhoids.
I know.
Yeah, we know. We know too. Napoleon and George Brett.
He was very superstitious. He carried a portrait of Josephine with him all the time, even after he divorced her, and he thought it brought him luck. And he was also said to have had a mathematical theorem. Well, he has a mathematical theorem named after him called Napoleon's Theorem. You want to hear what it states?
Sure.
Oh, it's a good one. If equilateral triangles are constructed on the sides of any triangle, the centers of those triangles themselves form an equilateral triangle. Yeah, Napoleon's theorem. A couple other quick things. He was said to be despite being a great general, he was said to be a very poor horseman and a terrible shot with a gun.
He was more of an aggressive, take what he could get type.
He was Europe's bully.
Take everything. Yeah, he was a bully.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good way to define him in this day and age. He was a bully.
But, you know, he was a bully with a romantic heart because he did very much love Josephine.
Not enough to stay married to her, though, apparently. So so what happened to these kids?
Well, interestingly, he only had one legitimate child. So he had a few acknowledged illegitimate children.
Not a huge fan of that term. Out of wedlock.
Okay, his out of wedlock children, I don't know that anything happened with them. You know, again, Napoleonic law didn't give them very many rights. But his son with his wife, his second wife, named Francois Charles or Charlet Joseph Napoleon, he died at the age of 21 in 1832. He actually succeeded Napoleon as Emperor of France briefly, and by briefly I mean a couple of weeks before Louis XVIII came back in, took over.
But I think I remember hearing about Napoleon II or something. They
that were, that was Napoleon II.
He was there for 2 weeks.
Yes, he was there for 2 weeks.
Because
he wasn't strong enough to keep control. And the king who had been ousted during the revolution came back, like that line of secession, the royals that they had fought off in the first case, the Louis.
Wonder how tall he was.
Now, there was a Napoleon III who was actually a cousin who came later in France, was a part of, you know, head of France later in life, but I don't know anything about him.
He's probably more like, that was probably more like Gallagher too.
Electric Boogaloo. So yeah, he definitely is one of those people that people would probably recognize a portrait of him because they're pretty famous. And you know, that move where you put your hand in the pocket, that was said to have been a sign of confidence. A lot of people wondered if it was maybe his hand had been injured or maybe his stomach was in pain because he did die of stomach cancer, you know, and maybe he was holding that. But really, that was sort of a sign at the time that you were confident, that you were calm. By having your hand in there, it showed that you were a man of leadership and high stature.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is a Napoleon move, though, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Many people during that time period copied him in their portraits and such. It was kind of
funny. In fact, if I went to Elba on vacation and I was getting a picture taken, there's 100% chance I would do
that. And wear a pointy hat.
If I had one, I don't really have
one. Oh, if you go to Elba, you got to get one.
You think they sell them?
Oh, I'm sure they do.
I wonder if they celebrate him on Elba. Like, is that a tourist place where you can go? And because that's the one place that I know of. I don't even know where it is, but I associate that with him.
I don't know if they celebrate him, but you know, his body was buried on Elba, and it was eventually brought back to France, like in 1840, and when it was. They allowed, you know, like they had a state funeral for him, and like 700,000 people came out to that state funeral.
Wow.
Well, hey, man, that's Napoleon Bonaparte. If you haven't seen the movie, I would see it. I liked it. I thought it was just don't start it past like 6:30 in the evening, and you'll make it all the way through, or after a heavy dinner, or. You know, something like that.
Or watch it in two parts. You know, you can do that too.
Yeah, unless you rent it. You know, unless you do these digital rentals where they basically give you like...
And then you have 24 hours to watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, in which case you're like paranoid that you won't get through it. So, but yeah, Napoleon, quite a guy. Hope you enjoyed it. And if you like this kind of thing, please be sure to subscribe to us. Check us out on Facebook as well. DirtNap City on Facebook. Or DirtNap City Podcast. And how can they reach us, Alex?
Reach us meaning how, what? Meaning what? What you can email us at not and then the little at symbol dirtnapcity.com
or Alex's phone number is 713 713-